Accession number 28459, Reel 2.
Nora Boswell, Reel 2. What did he mean by that when he said you?
Because I put the anchor on upside down on the counterpane. It was really.
Were you disciplined for all that, or?
No, absolutely. If I did it again, I would be. Absolutely. And of course, if you and there was a long passages with the matting down, all pretty bare and huge canteen.
Could we perhaps pause there a bit and go into a bit more detail about the accommodation? First of all, could you perhaps describe the cabin in a bit more detail?
Well, it was like a sort of hospital unit. There were little walls, so there was about 10 people in each section. And you shared a chest of drawers, and there was somewhere to hang your stuff. And then there was an ablution place, of course, which you walked to in the mornings. And there was a recreation room, but it was all dark brown linoleum, and nobody had bothered to decorate or do anything. You'd have thought people would, but they didn't. They seemed to accept it as it was, because I think of where it was when you came off duty. You see, you could do what you like, and I have to tell you that it was only 1 11 pence for the return ticket to London. And then I'm rather leaping about a bit, I'm sorry. And then the Americans arrived and were all stationed very near us, because it was the head of the Air Force Administration things up there. And, of course, they were wonderful, those wonderful uniforms. And we used to hitch rides with them up to London, and they gave us nylons and all sorts of things which went on. But we actually had no training for the job, whatever. And
before we move on to that, perhaps could I just deal with the layout of the place first of all? You mentioned where you slept.
Yes.
Was that inspected regularly?
Oh, yes. To make sure it was kept tidy. And there was a lousy job, stewards, who were exactly the same as us, and they came and mopped it all up, you know, and cleared up every day.
So you didn't have to clean it up?
No. The rains didn't clear. There was the stewards did that, which I thought was rather bad. And they were a little bit like, you know, looked. And then you went down to the canteen, where the cooks and the stewards did the food. And I don't remember the food being that awful. But of course, we had to eat in the middle of the night and when we were on duty. But it was very reminiscent of a continuation of school and of boarding school, because there is no doubt about it that we were all having to sign the Official Secrets Act, and I think there were 300 or 400 of us stationed there, and looking back on it, they didn't care what our intelligence was, but in their books we were very old-fashioned thing. Nice girls, and nice girls keep their secrets. And that's why they chose us. And it is quite amazing when you think of the whole setup for Bletchley and all these people doing it, and nobody spoke about it.
When were you asked to sign the Official Secrets Act?
After we arrived at Stanmore, where I was stationed. And then they took us through this sort of into the Holy of Holies, which was all wired off, and was where they did it, where we did the machines were. And then on that first day, you were told to sign the Official Secrets Act. And of course, if you broke it or anything, well, I mean, you're going to be shot. Really.
Did you know why you were being asked to sign the Official Secrets Act?
No, we just knew that we were going to do something special duties.
When did you find out what exactly it was that you were required to do?
Then they came and spoke to us and told us and brought along the bombs, these great machines, and explained to us what we would be doing and that we were trying to break the codes.
What sort of training did you receive in order to be able to use these bombs or computers.
So, yes, I mean, it was like, I mean, we were human computers, that's what it comes down to. Enormous great things, probably almost, well, like that length there, these huge things.
About 20 foot.
Yes, probably about that. And they were all named, they were in different bays, about 20 in each bay, and they were named after various Commonwealth countries. And still, when I look at New Zealand and I see towns like Dunedin and Gisborne, I think, oh my God, that was the name of those machines. We were shown, told what we had to do, and that was it, really.
Could you perhaps describe in a bit more detail? You said what? There were different machines.
Yes.
In the room. Where exactly was the room, as it were?
Well, this was a completely, I mean, purpose-built unit with these bays leading off it. And each bay would have about 12 of these bombs, as they were called, the machines in it. All done, of course, through Alan Turing at Bletchley. He did come and talk to us. And then there was a little room on the outside, which is where, if the machine stopped, which means that there was a possibility they got the code, you know, right, and then it went into this little room where you sat down and it looked like an Enigma machine, and if the things corresponded, then you took it through, and with a bit of luck, they'd say job up, but it didn't happen all that often. All we knew was that blue was the Navy and brown was Army, and if a job, as they say, came up. But the noise of those machines, and also I think it was asking a lot of us to stand for 8 hours.
So each watch was 8 hours long.
Yes.
Can you describe what it was like to operate the machines, how many people were operating them, each machine, and exactly what your job involved, and how you were taught how to do it?
You were given, each person had a machine, so when I came on at 12, I took over from somebody else.
And did you have to sign on, or did you have to, what documentation did you have?
Yes, you simply signed on, and you knew where you were going to be, and there was an officer, a petty officer, who was in her little room, sending the messages through, and then it would be handed out from Bletchley through to us. And I think it must all have been done by teleprinter when I look back on it. And you went to your machine, and your job was, first of all, they'd come along with this diagram, and you had to plug up the back of the machine where you were told to, putting the things in the right sockets. And
when you say things in the right sockets?
Well, it's like putting a plug in a socket today. But it was all the back of this, but you've got to do it absolutely meticulously. And then you went round to the front of the machine, which was three bands, 1, 2, 3, and each of those had three drums on it. And you were told which drums you'd got to put on, and what they were to be set at. But these drums were heavy, and the back of them was an absolute mass of little tiny short wires, and we all had our tweezers, and none of the wires must touch each other. And it really was, because otherwise the machine would stop. And so we would set it up as we'd been told to, take the colour, the things off the shelves, and lift them and put them on the machine.
When you say the colour, what does
that mean? There was different they would tell you whether you were to put on red, blue, or what you were to do for the machine. And
did you understand what that meant? Or
well, vaguely, but they didn't. You see, I think that because they wanted us not to leak anything, they didn't tell us very much. I mean, that was the best way of doing it. But these discs had the alphabet round them, and you had to set them at certain places. And then they'd come and have a look and see if you'd set your machine up properly.
And how long would that take, the setting up of the machine?
I suppose it would probably take about an hour, something like that. And then there were also RAF men who were the technicians, because lots of these drums had to be chucked out or weren't right. And then with a bit of luck, you could set your bomb going and wait for when it stopped. That meant, you see, they were trying to work out all the possibilities of the break the codes. And when it stopped, that meant that perhaps they'd got the right answer to it. And you took this through, and it had just got the three things on its ABA, three, whatever it was. And they would put that onto their machine. And if it answered theirs, then they'd take it through. But, of course, it didn't always. And I have to tell you that these machines broke down frequently. And that, of course, meant you could sit down.
I was going to ask you, how did you start the machine up?
How did you start the machine up? What a very good question. I think one just pulled a lever on the side, a massive lever on the side of it, and it went, yes. In a way, it was very basic. It was just the size and the noise of these machines.
Can you perhaps... was it deafening, the noise?
No, no. I mean, I could talk to other people. You could talk to other people. But that is what I find so incredible. The whole time, we had on these wretched stiff collars and... you just thought we'd have been in boiler suits or something.
What sort of noise did it make?
Ooh, like going into a garage, you know, very much like being in a mechanic's garage today. The sort of roaring noise.
And once the machine was operating...
Yes.
What did you do?
Well, waiting for it to stop, really. And you went, no, I'm so sorry. Once it was going, then your job was these wooden shelves behind you, long wooden shelves, about from there to there, these wooden shelves, and you went through and inspected all the drums to make sure that the wires weren't touching on them. And that was your job. And then they would come to you and they would say to you, you haven't inspected that properly, you know. Go back and do it again.
These were drums that were to be used in
the
future.
No, the drums that were going to be used on the machine.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes. And how frequently would you have to change the drums?
Well, when a job came up, or then, of course, you'd do it quite often. But they went wrong and you had to change them quite often. I always remember technicians coming round. When I think of it, what it must have cost, I mean, the manpower that was involved in it, and yet they said it was... marvellous. And I mean, we did know, they didn't tell us very much, but we did know when the Scharnhorst organiser was sunk that was because they'd broken the codes. But otherwise, we knew very little.
How did you know when the machine had stopped? I mean,
we just stopped.
Question.
No, the whole thing just went zonk like that and stopped.
And that meant that it may have solved...
And then you could read on it what it had stopped at, you see, and you took it through to see if that was...
So you handed the information on...
To another girl.
To the petty officer.
No, you went straight through with that, through a little sort of a small room, about half the size of this, where people were sitting with their machines, like an Enigma machine, and they set it up and saw if that was the right one or not. And what we used to do... 2 days of standing on the bombs and 2 days of sitting, and of course sitting was much more preferable to on the machines. That's what how they are. And then you got half an hour's break in the middle of the 8 hours, and you went across, which was about 5 minutes walk down to get food, and of course, so different to anything today. Once you left and came outside the compound, you never talked, of course, about what you'd been doing. So there was no talking about the work, or did you do this, or did you do that. It was like that.
Going back to just working the bombs,
yes,
as it were, at the moment, once the machine had stopped,
yes,
and you passed on the information, yes, to produce... Did you start it up again?
Yes, I've told you to start it up again. Or they'd often come along and say, oh, no, they decided that's not right, strip the whole thing and start again.
Would that mean you could use the same pieces of equipment in the machine if they asked you to continue?
Or yes, no, you just pressed a button and
it got going again.
But you had, in front of the machine, there was a big trestle table. And that's where you were meant to check these drums to make sure they were all right. But I can still see it now, these thousands of little wires which you had to... I'm surprised it didn't damage all our eyesight, but nobody bothered about that.
So how many people were working these?
There'd be about 12 machines, so that would be 12 people there and 12 people on, so you'd be 24 to a bay.
And how many bays were there?
About 12 bays. And that's one outstation, because the other one was Woburn, but they went into Bletchley. But we didn't actually realise, because it wasn't talked about, we just knew that Bletchley was where the chief officers were, but we didn't really realise that people, the decoding that was going on there. I mean, and I never even told my parents what I was doing. And when you went out, we didn't have badges, you see. That I thought, on our arms, most people, if you were a driver or a boat's crew or something, you had a badge. But we didn't have badges, and you just had to say, well, I'm in P5 doing special duties, and that was that.
You mentioned that you spent 2 days operating the bombs, as it were. And 2 days operating the
decoding machines.
Can you describe what that was like and what that involved, that aspect of your job?
The sitting down part of it. Well, you went into the room and there were these little machines which looked rather like an Enigma machine, and it had got like a typewriter on it, and you'd got what the stop was, and you'd put these figures in and then it lit up, and if it was right... It lit up, and if it was wrong, it didn't.
What sort of information did it... when you say it lit up, what lit up?
Well, the numbers lit up, and you press the keys, and it would come up with the numbers on it. Yes, it did. It came up with the numbers. They were quite small machines. Very much more like the Enigma machine, which you all know about. But that didn't have... It didn't have drums on it. I'm pretty certain it didn't have drums on it. No, it just, you tapped it out on it, and if it responded.
Did it produce a printout, or did it...
Yes, it did, and if it agreed with... You see, that was the whole thing. It was very simple. If it agreed with what you'd been given, then that was a chance that we were breaking the code.
And what would happen to that information?
Then we would take that information through... to the officer in the room there, and that would all then be transmitted to Bletchley.
And in what form was the information produced? Was it produced as letters or
did we take numbers? A piece of mail? They knew, you see, exactly, that was their job to be. They were in charge of all the machines, and they knew what we were plugged into, so they'd got all the... But, I mean, it was all pencil and pen stuff and...
Did you know whether you were working on codes for the Navy, the Army? Or...
Yes, by the colour, I can remember that blue was the Navy and brown was the... And then, of course, the Japanese lot came in later on. But that's what we knew by the colours that it was. And I remember I asked at one time why we couldn't have... they came very occasionally. We couldn't have more lectures that we would be... Because it was boring, let's face it, it was very boring, that we would be much more inspired if somebody would come and talk to us from the Navy, the Army or the Air Force and tell us what was happening. But they weren't keen, you see, they didn't want us to have the information.
I mean, presumably you knew you were code-breaking, involved in that process.
Yes.
But did you know anything else at all?
No.
Where you fitted into the whole...
Well, we knew that it went through to Bletchley, but we didn't know what happened to it at Bletchley. And we knew that they'd got huts there where they were working, you know, on it. But it's very difficult for me, because so much has been written since, to know what I actually got from books. And one of the most amazing books is Richard Harris's book. Is it Richard Harris, Enigma? I can't quite remember his name, but he wasn't even born then. But his description of it all is absolutely correct about it all.
You mentioned the fact that Alan Turing did come down to speak to you.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
He was just somebody came from Bletchley to told us we were doing a jolly good job and get on with it.
He didn't tell you what it was all about?
Not really, no.
Did you realise his significance in the whole process?
No, it wasn't until afterwards the name Alan Turing came up at all. And of course now it was... I was absolutely horrified when it all went public and came out, because, I mean, we thought we were signed for life. We couldn't believe that it was all...
So you didn't speak about it to... You mentioned you didn't talk to anyone at all,
no.
Not even your family.
No. Absolutely.
When did you first speak about it after the war?
Oh. I mean, since I've been married, I mean, it must be... When it all came out with... I mean, that's in the last, 15, 20 years.
So you kept your silence for 30, 40 years?
Yes, absolutely. And, I mean... my husband knew that I'd been in the Wrens and I'd done special duties. I doubt if I even told him what it was we were doing. I mean, it's a different... See, there's no media or anything like that. And of course, there were dreadful things that were going on the whole time, and with one's friends and the people that were working there, because they'd obviously, a lot of them got partners and boyfriends and things, and they were in Anzio being killed or in the desert and being killed. And then there was D-Day, of course. But I think we were... You sort of just accepted it all. Sounds rather stupid, really. We didn't query it, but, I mean, that's the way they got us organised.
You said that you worked 8-hour watches.
Yes.
And that sometimes that you worked during the night.
Yes.
Can you describe how those watches were organised?
Yes. You started off the day watch. That was 8 till 4. You had a week of that, and then you had 24 hours off, and you could go away, do what you liked. Then you went on the next week from 4 to midnight. You did a week of that. And then you had a day and a 2 days off, I think, because they did have to give you quite a bit of time off, 2 days off, and I'd probably go home to Bromley and get the train and go home to Bromley for the night. Came back and you did night duty. It may have been for 10 days, which was 12 to 8. And then this happened every day. And then you got a 4-day pass. And you could travel anywhere in the UK. Travel warrants. And I remember we had great fun. We went up to the Lake District and Wales and Scotland on these. And that was because obviously they realised, they must have done, that we had to have that break. And then you came back again and went on to the 8 to 4 and routine.
Can you describe the hierarchy that you were operating in?
Yes,
an awful... What was your rank, actually?
I was just an ordinary Wren. My father, who had had great ideas, I was going to be something marvellous, but I was very pleased to tell him that you couldn't be an officer in the Wrens until you were 20, and I wasn't 20, so that was that. There was no chance of it. So we were just ordinary. I mean, as an ordinary rating. If I'd been good at... I wasn't good at it. I mean, I did it all, but really, I had too much of a questioning mind, I think, and it's rather like computers, isn't it, which you mustn't think about nowadays to work, you just do it. And then above us were the officers, all women, you see, and the chief officer was a woman. There were no, and that would have been through the whole of Enigma. It was very female-orientated, really.
Well, so apart from the technicians,
yes,
everybody else you worked with was female.
Yes. And so quite obviously, we had the odd dance and things, and there were always far too many. I mean, it was ridiculous. And there were poles that were stationed there as well. And you could go in, and in Stanmore, there were lots of places had canteens for the services, and you went into those. And, of course, when we were off duty, it sounds quite mad, went up to London a lot, because you could get free theatre tickets and all sorts of benefits for the services.
I'd like to come back to that a bit later, if I could. Can I talk about discipline?
Mm.
What was the discipline like? I mean, you've mentioned that you had to wear these dad collars,
yeah,
and also that when you turned up in a sweater, you got sent back.
Yes.
Can you remember anything else about the discipline? Was it strict? Were you punished if
for
any breaches?
Yes, and you were sent up to see the chief officer. I was, of course, the great thing was, you see, you got to be back half an hour before you went on watch, and of course the night watch, that meant you got to be back by 11:30. Well, you can imagine, if you were having a good time up in London, and the underground, and you desperately ran, and I was, it was strict. I was late 2 times running, I think within a month, and I was sent before the officer, and I said that I had been somewhere and I hadn't liked to leave because it had been so rude, and they said, oh, you know, that didn't matter, that I should have come back. And as a result, when it came to the 4 days leave, I had a day knocked off it, and I had to stay behind and scrub floors. So it was tough.
Can you remember any other things which would attract a disciplinary?
Well, one of the great things was if you've got a chap in there, quite obviously.
Did that happen often?
It could happen, because it was there was a high wall, and they were very tough on leave, and were quite a lot of married people that were doing it, had got married, and that they were going off the husbands, and they couldn't get leave, and so everyone would leave that part of the cabin to them, and they'd be left there, and then in the morning we'd all hike them over the wall. Because, but you see, in those days it was very different, because you say we obviously boyfriends and everything, but it wasn't loose, because everyone was terrified of getting pregnant, let's face it. And if you did that without being married, I mean, I think you'd probably be, well, I mean, that was it.
Was anybody caught with
yes,
a boyfriend?
Yes, husband? They were, yes.
And what happened to them?
Oh, God knows what didn't happen to them. They had, you know, all their privileges stopped for a month. But it was this ridiculous thing of, and you see, that was me. I'd been adrift, you see. I hadn't been late to come back. And I remember them saying to me, my name was Knight, do you realise, Knight, that you have been adrift twice in the last month? And I felt like saying, what? But I suppose it had to be run like that. You had to have discipline in it.
You've mentioned that you had to salute the flag on the quarter deck.
Yes.
Were there any other sort of rules as such that you found a little irksome?
That was the big thing, and you had to always sign in with your passes, of course. You had to have a pass when you went in and when you went out. And then, of course, some of them, yes, I am right, some of them, I didn't volunteer, and I think I was a coward over that, went to Ceylon to Trincomalee, getting ready for the Far East War, and there was a big unit there doing it, and they did send quite a lot of people out there, and I regret that I didn't do that, really.